everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show on Civic Media. You can join the conversation for these Thursday thoughts at 844-967-2789. You know, if you wish for a slow news day, well, that was not today. So much going on, E. I mean, let's just start where we've got to because of what we talked about yesterday on the show, which is the shared revenue and sales tax deal has been struck between the Republicans in the state legislature and Governor Tony Evers. For all of you that may have been tuned in yesterday and heard me talk about this, we can decry certain provisions of this legislative package, but its impact and help to the city and county of Milwaukee cannot be denied. I want to express thanks to the governor for seeing through some of the performative politics, again, a theme here on the Maggie Dawn Show, to get to the meat of the issue, which was we need money here in southeastern Wisconsin, and we need it now. Here's the reporting. Just came out today in the Journal Sentinel. Republican legislative leaders and Democratic Governor Tony Evers have struck a deal to prevent Milwaukee from dropping off a fiscal cliff that includes more funding for local governments, while also sending more dollars to public, charter, and private school voucher schools in a sweeping agreement that will allow area leaders to raise sales tax revenue without a referendum. There's some big changes happening in educational funding. A lot of things about the voucher school payments going from about $8,400 to $9,500 per student in K through eight, from about $9,000 to $12,000 per high school student. Listen, we can devote an entire show, and we will, Evan, remind me to do this, on what works and what doesn't about voucher and charter schools. But there was no question that those were some of the compromises that Republicans were going to extract from the governor about educational funding and the Republican commitment to continue to use taxpayer dollars to fund religiously based education in this state and beyond. Of course, we talked a little bit yesterday about the various provisions in the bill that are designed to strip the county and the city of some of our tools of local control, requiring a certain level of police to be maintained, et cetera, et cetera. But here's what I want to point out. There's been a lot of ink spilt about the spending restrictions that are placed on the sales tax. But here's what. We all know that dollars are fungible. So if you only have $1 million worth of tax levy, and somebody says, I'm going to give you $5,000 and you can only use it for this. Well, if you want to spend $5,000 of that tax levy on that anyways, it's like saving $5,000. So as an economic matter, I want to be really clear here. Yes, there are restrictions in this package on how the city and county can spend that sales tax revenue. It's basically designated to help shore up pensions. And a note on that in a moment. But the other revenue and sort of the dollars moving around, in effect, on an economic basis, this is going to free up dollars for both the city and the county to fund the things that make life better here in southeastern Wisconsin and help keep this a destination city for tourism and a place that people want to live. Here's what Evers had to say today. For far too long, our communities have been asked to do more with less, and this agreement is critical to ensure our local partners have the resources they need to meet basic and unique needs alike. After working through much of last night, I have reached a tentative agreement with both Majority Leader LeMahieu and Speaker Voss on major provisions of a compromise on shared revenue that will mean historic increases in support for our local communities across Wisconsin. Importantly, the deal allows the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County to put in place the sales tax increases without a referendum, based on a reported two-thirds majority vote and the sign-off by both chief executives in the county and the city. So that means two-thirds of the city of Milwaukee's common council have to agree to put the sales tax in place. I think that that's a doable proportion. A unanimous vote would have been hard to get to, but two-thirds, I think, is doable. And the same applies for the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. Here's what Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley had to say about this deal. Quote, when you work on a bill as historic and far-reaching as this one, not everyone will get everything on their wish list. Nevertheless, this deal helps keep our organization avoid the single biggest threat to achieving its goal its goals and sets our region up for long-term success. Hooray, and I could not agree more. He continued, anyone who wants to see Milwaukee County avoid the reported service cuts or staff reductions and continue its journey to achieve race and health equity should support this deal. So to be clear, if approved by the Common Council of the City of Milwaukee and the County Board of Supervisors, the city will newly put in place a 2% sales tax within the city of Milwaukee's boundaries. That means that everybody that comes from outstate and from the flatland to our south and from our brothers and sisters to the east in Michigan and comes into Milwaukee to watch the Bucks, watch the Admirals in the finals, which I guess they're in right now. I'm not a huge hockey fan, but they're in it to win it. Come watch the Brewers to enjoy the symphony, to enjoy our bridges and roads and our downtown environment with our beautiful river and our lakefront, that all these folks will be paying 2% sales tax. And it means for the county, we can make approximately a small increase. It's about 0.4% increase in the county sales tax to bring the county portion of a sales tax to just under 1%. It'll be at 0.9%. These are game-changing numbers. Now, is this going to make all of the city's financial problems disappear overnight if it is passed? No, there's still going to be some belt tightening, but we're not going to be shutting down like half of the library system, gutting the police force, and stopping picking up garbage and snow, right? Like, this is essential. We're talking about baseline services. But here's a little something that also came out today that I wanted to share. There's two particular things that if you want to chime in on whether or not you think this is a good deal, 844-967-2789. This article came out as well today in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You may recall, if you are a state of Wisconsin resident, and certainly if you live in the southeastern portion, that a number of years ago, the state basically took away the residency requirement that applied to city workers and said that city employees should be able to live wherever they want. Now, we're going to not get into the policy debate about whether or not that's a good idea. Personally, if you want to be paid by taxpayers, you can make a pretty simple argument that you should be one of those taxpayers, that you should have a vested interest both in your employment and where your tax dollars, your property tax dollars are going, and you should live in the jurisdiction that you want to get paid by. But setting that aside, since the state imposed this on the city of Milwaukee, the number of city employees living within the city has dropped 43%. And 59% of that exodus has been fire and police force leaving the city. That means 3,000 of some of the city's best paid workers have taken their paychecks and moved out of the city. I would be remiss if I didn't say this was part of what we're talking about here. And yes, the state is coming. State GOP is coming again for its pound of flesh, and they've gotten it in this bill. But we must continue to do business. I just think we've got to talk about that, that the folks that protect us don't want to live with us. This is Alderman Mark Borkowski remarking on this mass exodus of police and firefighters out of the city of Milwaukee since 2013. Quote, for someone who is a proponent of public safety, this is very discouraging. He went on to call these numbers embarrassing. Yeah, this matters. It matters that folks that enjoy some of the richest pension benefits in the state don't want to live in the districts whose taxpayers support those pension benefits. It's part of the whole mix of how we got here. And I want to take a pause. I see you, Earl, coming in. Bill, I see you as well from Madison. I'm going to ask you to hold on for 1 second. I want to make this observation about the pensions. Current leadership had nothing to do with the pension problems. Current leadership and current employees in the city and the county had nothing to do with the pension problems. I can draw some nuances at the city because of the fact that police and fire still enjoy the privilege of collective bargaining, which Republicans saw fit to strip every other public employee in the state of. And for that reason, they do have some responsibility when it comes to pension. But city leaders and county leaders and the current county employees and general city employees had nothing to do with creating the current pension problem. Now, Earl, because I respect you and listened to your show this morning, I want to hear what you have to say, because I know that you are angry and fired up about the stripping of so much local control, including control of the police and fire departments from the city of Milwaukee in this bill. Earl, tell me what you have to say.
Hey, Maggie, first off, congratulations on the new show.
Thank you, sir.
Couldn't happen to a more deserving person than you. But quickly, whole thing with the residency has been a thorn in my side, not just now, but back when Scott Walker and the Republicans decided to do this. I had always said that if people wanted it to say that it was discriminatory to force people to live in the city of Milwaukee, I always said was wrong, because those jobs belong to the taxpayers. They don't belong to individuals. And I did not understand how they could make the argument that this was discriminatory to force people to live in the city of Milwaukee when, you know, people, if they want to be a police or a fire person, then nobody's preventing them for doing that where they live. But those particular jobs belong to the taxpayers, like you and I, who live in this city, and they should have never been allowed to do what they did. Thank you.
Hey, man, I couldn't agree with you more. I'll explain why it is simply not discriminatory as a point of law when we come back. I am Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. If you are on hold, stay there. I will get to you in the next segment. This is Sick Media. You can always listen to us on the app, otherwise on your favorite local radio station. Keep it locked in, 844-967-2789 if you want to join the debate. Maggie Dawn, and this is the Maggie Dawn Show. Join the debate, 844-967-2789. We're talking about the shared revenue and sales tax bill that the governor, Senate Majority Leader LeMahieu, and Speaker Voss announced today that is going to be a lifeline for the city and county. Now, it's got a lot of stuff in there that nobody's going to like. We knew that was part of what we could expect. It's littered with hypocrisy. But what we're going to get is the cash, and it's cash that will help the city and the county serve our most vulnerable residents and keep the quality of life in Milwaukee where it is, and hopefully improve it and craft a new generation, a new version of government for folks in southeastern Wisconsin. Right now, the city and the county are engaged in a professionally led efficiency and effectiveness review. It is basically like bringing in consultants to tell you everything that you're doing wrong and everywhere there's waste. Actively doing that. I believe we are seeing a page turn in local government here in Wisconsin. But before we went to break, Earl had mentioned, and we had been talking about, the lifting of the city of Milwaukee's residency requirement and the arguments that had been made that that is somehow discriminatory. Here's what. It's not. If you know that a condition of your job is that you have to live in the city of Milwaukee, your option's simple. Don't take a job with the city of Milwaukee. It's a work rule. Employers get to set those. If you want to work here, you got to live here. You took the job, and that means you accepted that work rule. It was completely ridiculous to later argue that that was somehow unfair. And I think it sits so much more wrongly, or really gets stuck in my craw, when we're talking about it in reference to the mass exodus exodus, that 60% of the folks that left the city in the wake of that decision by the state GOP and Governor Walker have been police and firefighters. So just want to be clear, yeah, that's not discriminatory. That's a work rule, and you knew it when you took the job, so you don't get to complain about it when you're cashing your paycheck. Bill from Madison, what do you have to say this afternoon?
I just had a question. So it sounds like you're in complete favor of the sales tax increase in Milwaukee if it goes through, right?
Yes.
Okay, you said that, yeah, the people from out of state will pay and the tourists will pay. You know who else is going to pay? The low-income struggling people that live in Milwaukee are going to pay. The elderly are going to pay. All those people are going to pay. You're talking about, all the police and EMS and fire don't want to live there. Do you think they're going to want to live there with an increased sales tax?
I think it is economically a non-starter to make an argument that we have any other choice. And secondly, that people will move because of a 2% sales tax. That's not borne out when you look at statistics from most jurisdictions. They'll move based on property taxes. And there's actually some sort of indirect property tax relief baked into this whole deal. So no, I don't think people are going to leave because sales taxes go up by 2%. Now, your first point, my friend Bill, was that sales taxes are regressive. I dealt with that yesterday. To the extent that poor people at risk, elderly, folks with disabilities, students have to pay more in tax, do I think that's a good thing? No, sir. But when you talk about taxation and our options here, you always have to talk about these things relative to what alternative. We can argue that sales taxes aren't good because, yes, they hit poor folks, but it's not like the city has the power to levy a separate income tax. By the way, some cities in this country do. New York City's for one. Minneapolis, I believe, is another. So income tax isn't on the board. Property taxes we can't raise. By the way, those get passed back to renters just the same as property owners. And so sales taxes, which do not apply to food and medical supplies, are considered by policy experts to be one of the least regressive forms of tax out there. So Bill, if you don't like the sales tax, how are we going to pay for the stuff that we need in southeastern Wisconsin? What say you, friend?
First off, I would review any of the spending on beautification items and stuff like that.
So, that's been done, Bill. Let's not waste time on nonsense. I'm not going to do that on the show because this is too important. Okay. We don't spend a huge amount of money. Bill, give me a second, brother. Bill, if you want to have an argument about the policy, let's have an informed argument about the policy. This isn't about misspending on beautification. What is your alternative, if it's not a sales tax, to continue to fairly fund government and the essential services that we provide in southeastern Wisconsin? I'm going to give you one more shot at it, Bill. Go ahead and tell me what your alternative is.
We need definite change from the leadership and the state government. The way that they do shared revenues is completely wrong. I think we can agree on that.
Wonderful.
And they need to change it or do something. I'm not in agreement of punishing people because the state representatives can't do their job and come up with a fair way to spend property tax.
All right, my brother, we have found a place of agreement. I love this, right? So we're talking about shared revenue and fairness and getting rid of the performative politics, right, my brother? That is the whole idea here, is that we actually need to come together and talk about what these revenue and funding solutions are. And I'll just respectfully offer this up. The county is engaged in a decade-long cost-cutting campaign that rivals any that any government, including state government, has engaged in the last 10 years. We have cut 3 million square feet of building space. We have gotten rid of close to 4,000 employees. We have tightened our belts and engaged in pension reform. So yes, we need shared revenue, but the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, just like everybody else, deserve the right to apply a sales tax. Thanks for the call, Bill. Hang in there, everybody. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. I am Maggie Dawn. If you are on hold, stay there. We're going to talk about the massive SCOTUS decision that just dropped when we come back from this break. Join the debate, 844-967-2789. We hope to do here on the Maggie Dawn Show is wake everybody up, right? Thanks, Evan, for the great tunes. Been enjoying that a lot. Folks, I've said before, if you've got topics, issues you want me to cover, that you want me to weigh in on, don't hesitate to reach out. You can always call or text 844-967-2789, but you can also email me, maggie.dawn, that's D-A-U-N, at civicmedia.us. The one thing I did forget to do, and I hope he's still listening, is I need to give a big, huge, heartfelt thanks to Mr. Earl Ingram. I would not be on the radio right now but for Earl. He was the first person to ever interview me on the radio. He interviewed me about the opioid lawsuit that I'd filed on behalf of Milwaukee County's citizens and residents. And it just went from there, Evan. I've never been so lucky or so kindly treated by someone in the media. And I can never say thank you enough, Earl. You are really one of a kind and a true Milwaukee legend and asset. We're all better off because of you.
Really? We really are. He was the reason why I got on the radio for the first time.
How cool is this guy?
Yeah. So thank you, Earl.
Yeah, for real. I mean, Earl's an example of living the idea that if you've got a little, whatever it is, love, time, attention, access, radio time, you give it away and it multiplies, right? Like that is Earl Ingram to a T. We've been chopping it up about the sales tax and shared revenue deal that has gotten done here. Again, we still got to get it across the line, got to get the bill drafted and signed, but it looks like there is agreement in place. Now it's just up to those pesky lawyers to write it all down, always the issue. Now, there's one provision in this bill that I want to talk about very briefly because it ties into the Supreme Court decision, which I got to admit, I was totally shocked by today. And I have a little theory about what's going on with it. But the bill that we're talking about, the shared revenue sales tax deal, includes a couple of limitations on what the city and county can do in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion in hiring and contracting practices. So it prohibits the city from using tax money for, quote, funding any position for which the principal duties consist of promoting individuals or groups on the basis of their race, color, ancestry, national origin, or sexual orientation, end quote. The bill also says that neither the city nor county can use preferences in hiring or contracting based on race. My answer to that is, okay, we'll go get that done. Thanks, we've been doing that anyways. Talking about race and engaging the discussion that race matters and that we do see color does not mean that someone else is being hurt or illegally discriminated against. And I think that has been such a fallacy in how many judges have thought about affirmative action and contracting programs. I think it's a fallacy in what is baked into what the Republicans are saying when they include those kinds of provisions. Here's the deal, folks. Every meaningful objective study that has ever looked at this stuff, and we can look to other countries, most of which aren't quite as segregated as we are here in the United States, any objective study done by meaningful economists on this has shown that when things are more equitable, when your economics are more equitable, when you don't see wealth dispersion so clearly defined by race, educational attainment, inherited wealth, when these things get more equitable and we don't see these divisions between races, and we also don't see these divisions between the working poor and the ultra rich, that everyone does better. That's the thing. You, if you're a white person, white working class, man, heterosexual, you will not do worse because Black folks and brown folks do better. You will do better too when we do better by each other. That high tide, it raises all ships, folks. But one of the interesting things about this provision in this bill is the fact that it's a little ironic, and the mayor was quick to point that out today. Just want to quickly recap this. Mayor Cavalier Johnson pointed this out today. Quote, the RNC itself, the National Committee, working to drive home the point that diversity, equity, and inclusion is important because they signed an agreement to that effect with the city of Milwaukee to host the RNC. So that's a little weird. The National Committee is saying, yes, DEI is really important in the city. But the GOP here in Wisconsin doesn't really think so. The mayor went on, I thought it was some interesting irony as well that the Republican Party of Wisconsin decided to open up and keep open offices in predominantly communities of color in Milwaukee. There's one right on MLK. If y'all haven't driven past that, I see it's MLK and North Avenue on the, let's see, southwest corner. So they're in predominantly Latino and Black neighborhoods right at North Avenue and King Drive and Bronzeville. And so the mayor went on, you're putting out this message that you value diversity because you've got these political offices in communities of color, that you value equity. You want people of color to be involved in your political party. And that, I assumed, meant you wanted to have a big tent. But then in the next breath, you bake this into the bill. It's just one of those things that, boy, sometimes performative politics, you want to have your cake and eat it too. Yes, if you're Black and brown folks. Please join the GOP, but let's be sure that, you know, the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County don't take into account race in any hiring or contracting preferences. I don't know how that washes, but in other news about the legacy of racism in our country, because let's just talk about it as if it's a thing, because it is, right? The Supreme Court today, in a shocking decision, 5-4, found that legislative maps drawn, you know, in that hotbed of equity and racial justice, also known as Alabama, that the legislative districts down there needed to get redrawn. That when 27% of the population in Alabama are folks of color, and yet only 14% of their congressional seats are held by persons of color, well, yeah. The Supreme Court found that indeed that violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Before I get into the detail of that decision, which is just really interesting, the group of justices that came together to uphold a lower court ruling that the Voting Rights Act had been violated. Very interesting bedfellows there. But before I get to that detail, I wanted to hear from my friend Mark from the SAC. Quickly, my friend, what do you have to say this afternoon?
Yeah, it's. I'm glad that there's some kind of agreement going through. I'm disappointed that both of this part of the bill that addresses, you know, the schools, the charter schools and religious schools are getting increased funding, that they're going to be held to the same standards as the public schools and be tested independently, so, you know, that we can tell that we're getting the value for our dollars that we're giving to them. But you bring up, you know, that the whole problem with race in this country that was on its way to being somewhat alleviated under Reconstruction. And that's going back over 100 years now. And then Reconstruction was ended and it started collapsing because you know, formerly, you know, people of color were actually achieving political office and power in the South after the Civil War under Reconstruction, which gradually got stripped away from them. People of color were finding positions in the federal government until Woodrow Wilson started instituting his Southern racist policies and denying them employment opportunities within the federal government. I mean, that we are still dealing with the legacy of racism in this country, and the Republicans might blather all they want about, oh, it's not a problem and you're not a problem anymore. We don't need affirmative action anymore. Well, the fact of the matter is that race is still the first thing you see when you see somebody else's face. I mean, and it is just that it is just sad that we haven't moved beyond that. I mean, they continue to think because somebody else gets a little bit, might be given a little bit different opportunity that's denying you your opportunity. I mean,
it assumes that we have that all of this is zero sum. Thanks for the call, Mark. Always good to hear from you. There's a baked in assumption and it's fed, I think, by one party much more than the other. And that's that this is all zero sum. And that if your neighbor does better, you by definition have to do worse. And that zero sum ideology is then sort of bolstered and bootstrapped with a lot of individualism, which is like, just worry about you and that's okay. You then tie that up with prosperity theology, which says if you're doing good and somebody else is doing bad, that's because you're a good person and God wants to bless you. And if that person is doing bad, that's because they're a bad person and God is punishing them. Right. And you blend all of that together in the American political historical context with the overt racism, which has always been part of the gig. I mean, Reconstruction ended with Jim Crow, right? And like the violent suppression of any person of color who had purchased or acquired land and was earning a living. It sought to decimate any enclaves of Black middle-class folks, which existed in the South. It ran every Black elected official in the South and up the Eastern Seaboard out of office. And this wasn't redressed in the U.S. courts until, well, the 60s. And so you put all that together in a blender and you keep telling people if someone else does a little bit better, that's because it's costing you. And meanwhile, the big fat cats laugh their way to the bank. They divide us so that we miss the point. All of this performative politics is to get us talking about the stuff that doesn't matter. But let's talk about something that deeply does matter. The Supreme Court today, again, in this 5-4 decision, found that Alabama had violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Here were the alignment of justices. This is just fascinating. Roberts wrote the majority opinion. And he was joined by the court's three liberal mayors, members, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, as well as the fifth was the surprising Brett Kavanaugh here, folks. Pushed me over with a feather. So you had Alito, Amy Coney Barrett, and let's see, Thomas, and I'm forgetting the fourth one. Those were the conservative wing. Justice Thomas wrote an absolutely rip-roaring dissent joined by all of those other conservatives. Here's what he had to say. Now, remember, Black folks in Alabama, Black and brown folks, 27% of the population, their legislative maps gave Black and brown voters their choice of elected official in only one of seven congressional districts. That math works out to 14%. Yeah. Ew. Like, that can't be right, can it? Like, no. The Supreme Court found very clearly and invoked, of course, Alabama's absolutely horrifying history of racial oppression and the oppression of Black and brown voters in that state, part of the totality analysis that is required under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Here's what Thomas had to say in the dissent. The majority's approach, he wrote, does not remedy or deter unconstitutional discrimination in districting in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't? No, I thought that's precisely what it does. Because here you had Black folks whose votes weren't as equal as white folks. Because if you draw a district to crack, that's what this is called, they're stacking and cracking, to crack highly contiguous communities of color so that white people can basically tell those communities of color who's going to represent them, read here a Republican. That is precisely racial discrimination. Listen, I'm going to continue to break this down when we get back from break, because I think it's, you know, there's a through line here, folks. The GOP in Wisconsin, in our gerrymandered state, and what's going on in Alabama, they may seem far away, but it's not. It's just next door. All this is the same stuff. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show on Civic Media. You can download the app from your favorite app store. And don't forget to call us today and weigh in on this really surprising Supreme Court decision, 844-967-2789. It's a moment in space today for former President Donald Trump, who just confirmed moments ago that he has in fact been federally indicted, confirmed by NBC News and also confirmed by several of Trump advisors just moments ago. He has been summoned to appear in federal court in Miami, more on that in a moment, on Tuesday at 3 p.m. Again, former President Donald Trump has been federally indicted related to his actions, intentional actions, that have constituted a national security threat. This is related to his intentional taking of highly sensitive national security documents, potentially at both Bedminster and Mar-a-Lago. We're breaking news here on Civic Media. Again, former President Donald Trump, it has been confirmed, has been federally indicted related to his intentional actions that have put the national security of this country in grave danger. He is going to be appearing again in Miami federal court. This is really important. I know the devil's touched on it a bit last hour, but for the predominant amount of time that Jack Smith, after he took over as special prosecutor, has been investigating the breaches of national security that Donald Trump engaged in when he took highly sensitive documents potentially relating to China. We know that there is a recording where he acknowledges that he possessed a classified document relating to Iran and its nuclear capabilities. Jack Smith, that there was a grand jury that was convened in Washington, D.C. We found out just this past week that the D.C. grand jury, which we knew had been winding down, but we found out newly this week that a grand jury had convened in Miami, potentially indicating a change of venue, or perhaps indictments proceeding in two separate federal courts, which is possible, though all relating to the same nexus of facts. And that is the president's intentional retention and possibly dissemination. We will not know until we see the actual indictment drop. That's thing one that I want us all cued into over this weekend. He's going to have a fit on Truth Social, right? We know that's happening. He's been doing it all week. Fairly clear when Trump lawyers came in and met with Jack Smith earlier this week for approximately 2 hours that it seemed imminent the charges were about to drop. And again, just confirmed moments ago here, breaking news on Civic Media, former President Donald Trump will be federally indicted and must appear in federal court on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday. This is historic. We know that Donald Trump has been charged criminally in the state of New York, but that is under state law in New York. No former or sitting United States president has ever been charged with a federal crime. Donald Trump will be a federal defendant charged with crimes so serious as to threaten the national security of this country. I don't want anybody talking about this as the documents case. This is a man engaging in intentional cover-ups, potentially, you know, losing the security footage to know who is coming in and out of Mar-a-Lago to a flood. Well, that's convenient, by the way, that happened in one of Donald Trump's other prior investigations.
Flood, Maggie. These things happen.
What?
Oh, yeah. What?
Well,
no,
oh, just a little water problem with the sensitive electronics. Nothing to see here.
That's right.
Here are the things I want everybody cued into as we look to the indictment. And the first thing, is he charged with retention and or dissemination of these national security documents. There are big differences there, right? Is he charged with obstruction separately? It's possible you could have an obstruction charge emanating out of the Florida federal court. You could potentially have the retention and dissemination, national security, espionage act charges in DC federal court. My gut here, guys, I'm going to go out, guys and gals, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to say it's probably going to be centralized in Florida. Here's why I think so. One, you've got a nexus of facts. Two, if you're dealing with something, a prosecution at this magnitude, this level of political acuity, if I know I've got the defendant dead to rights, I'm going to go to the venue that I think is most hostile to me, and I'm going to go get that conviction anyways. If I'm Jack Smith and I'm swinging a big axe, I go to Florida, his backyard, and I go convict former President Donald J. Trump. Lock him up. It is high time we acknowledge that this man has been a national security threat since day one to this country. We used to think that hush money payments to strippers and porn stars were the worst thing that could happen. No, he extorted Ukraine to dig up dirt on Joe Biden. And trust me, folks, I'll spend all the time you want talking about Hunter Biden and Burisma, because there's no there. There is absolutely not one scintilla of evidence that Joe Biden ever himself profited from any of his son's business dealings.
And as I understand it, the feds do not mess around. Their conviction rate is through the roof. They don't bring a case unless they can win.
And least of which, Jack Smith, who, by the way, used to work in the International Criminal Court. I mean, that guy is no freaking joke. I don't think I've seen a photograph of the guy when he's smiling. We got him from law school graduation. Did he crack a smile then? I don't know. So we've got obstruction. We've got potential espionage act. One of the questions, so federal indictments can be fairly bare bones. Oftentimes, federal prosecutors will engage in what's called a speaking indictment, which lays out the specific evidence here potentially of obstruction. So here we know, or at least it's been widely reported, that there is clear evidence of obstruction, which is the former White House counsel and personal Trump lawyers advising the president to return the documents, and then Trump's reported efforts to hide them at Mar-a-Lago and elsewhere, and then the specific lies that Trump told and caused to be told to the archives and the FBI related to those documents. That's all obstruction. Oh, and if they intentionally destroyed the electronic evidence of who is moving the documents around, that would be obstruction too. If there is a speaking indictment, pay attention to what is alleged in the factual details. We're going to know if they reference tapes, if they reference testimony. Boy, that's going to tell you a lot of the strength of Jack Smith's case. You may see indications of what the classified documents might be. Is it about China? Again, is it about Iran's missile program? Is it about possible war plans? All things which we know have been reported as possibilities. Lastly, look to whether or not we're seeing conspiracy charges. That's possible. What the alleged motive might be. Finally, take a look at what judge gets assigned, because if it's that genius Aileen, boy, we're in deep do. Listen, breaking news here on Civil Media, former President Donald Trump, now federal defendant. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is The Maggie Dawn Show. I'll be back on Monday. I always want to hear from you. Thanks for keeping it locked.